So I'm Eli Portillo. I am the senior editor for news and planning here at WFAE, and I also oversee our race and equity coverage and our newsletter Equilibrium, equal spelled like equal, so you can sign up for that online. And this is Jose Antonio Vargas, as you already know. So, Jose, I'm sure most of the people here know your story, but go ahead and just tell us how you came to be in this room and doing the work that you do. What's the backstory?
How much time do I have to do that?
Well, let's do it in like two. Let's do it in a minute or two.
Okay, a brief background, and then I want to really talk more about like what I'm doing now, just because. So I'm happy to be, by the way, in North Carolina. My first time here was in 2007, covering John Edwards. Remember John Edwards?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I spent a week with John Edwards in 2007, and that was my first trip out here. And even back then, this was at in the Research Triangle. Even back then, you were seeing kind of how immigrants, you know, were coming into the state, starting and helping start new industries and really diversifying this area, right, in many areas in the South. So that was my first time. And back then I was a reporter for the Washington Post as a political reporter. And then a few years later, outed myself as undocumented in 2011 and started an organization called Define American. And which is, in many ways, the goal of it is in the name, right? Like, so how do we define American? But the way we do that is, how do we define American through the stories we tell, right? And what is the role of the media? And when I say the media, which is a huge thing, I'm talking about not only what's in the Charlotte Observer or what gets aired, you know, in your station, but you know, what we see on television, right? Like what you see in Orange is the New Black, or what you see in television and movies, what you hear in podcasts. So all forms of media. So in the past 12 years now, which is crazy since we started Define American, we've been kind of the go-to place of, if you have a TV show or a film and you're featuring immigrants, you go to us. We read your script. We consult on the script. We basically make sure that you're not misspreading information, right? And informing people about immigration as a process, not as a political partisan football, but as a process that most Americans themselves don't understand, and immigrants as people, not just as labor, right? Unfortunately, the framing as immigrants is part of the economic, you know, survival of the country and the states, that narrative, we play that out pretty well. But I think in many ways we forget that we're actually talking about human beings and not just, you know, high-skilled or low-skilled laborers. So that's what I do. And I have to say, I knew that I was coming to North Carolina for a special reason this time around, but I was just in Winston-Salem, and there's a book event called Bookmarks. I don't know if you remember. And they have this program called Books for Purpose. And so they bought 4,500 copies of Dear America and distributed it in every school and library in Winston-Salem. And so yesterday I met all these students who read the book, this book that I wrote. It was kind of amazing. And to have that very intimate, you know, books are interior things, right? And it was really wonderful, actually. That's why I'm in North Carolina.
Yeah, so it's been, gosh, I don't know, almost three decades since you realized you are undocumented when you were trying to get a driver's license.
Yeah.
Sorry if that's
very aging.
Outing your age.
No, I'm good. 42.
And it's been 11, 12 years since you outed yourself as undocumented with a public article. And it's been 5 years since Define America, your first book, was published, a memoir.
Dear America, yeah.
Dear America,
yeah.
I'm sorry. Define, dear.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So what has changed since your journey started, both your personal journey of realizing wow, I'm undocumented. What does this mean for my life? And your public journey in talking about your experience and other people's experiences. What changes have you seen over that time? And maybe just as importantly, what hasn't changed?
I'll answer the second part first. I did not realize that I would be trading a state of purgatory for another state of purgatory. You know, so I was in the closet about being undocumented for 14 years, from 16 to 30. I thought I'd come out as undocumented. Back then, immigration reform was still nominally in the headlines. You know, senators are guaranteed to get a new segment out of it if they make a speech on Capitol Hill, right? Both Democrat and Republican. So it was in the news cycle a lot more. I did not, if you would have told me 12 years ago that I would still be doing, that Defiant American would still exist, and that I would not only be talking about still being undocumented, but also the fact that immigration reform is not even a part of the conversation. So that's a big change. Like, I don't even think about immigration reform anymore. Like, it's not in my... It feels like some sort of like a magical, fantastical land that Gabriel Marcia Marquez and Toni Morrison thought about somewhere that I can't even think about, right? And I think that's really sad. But in the same time, I think it's really sobering. You know, like, I was reminded when I flew into Greensboro yesterday, I was going to rent a car. And then... my assistant reminded me that my California driver's license is not valid in the great state of North Carolina, and that I would get in trouble. Like, if I use my license from California and then get pulled over here, I'd get in trouble, and it's not worth it. So I ended up getting a car, or, you know, a Lyft to just figure that out. And then I'm thinking, so then of course I looked up, you have what, 380,000 undocumented people in North Carolina? Is that...
That's the latest estimate I've seen, something like that.
I mean, whenever I go to North Carolina, though, I always meet someone that I'm wondering if they're part of that 380,000, right? I think that's an undercount. So how do people get around in the state if you're undocumented? Is there a subway system I don't know about?
Well, we got the train there, but it only kind of goes north-south, so...
So, like, I would rather North Carolina figure out how are you going to allow your... neighbors and your coworkers and the people that you actually rely on, how are you going to make sure that they can drive to work and drop their kids off to school and make sure that they don't pee their pants when they see a police officer or a sheriff driving? That's the question for me. Never mind immigration reform. Never mind what Trump is saying. Never mind that you're 1,000 miles from the border and somehow... You know, when I went away, just on my way here, reading the news coverage, I mean, you would think that there's some sort of an epidemic happening in North Carolina when it comes to the border, and you're 1,000 miles from it. I'd rather think about the borders in our minds and what stops us from actually doing the logical, rational things that have nothing to do with being a Republican or being a Democrat. I want to talk about that, right? I want to talk about the fact that you have how many community colleges, and you have students here who can't, who have to pay out-of-state tuition to be in your community colleges? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that, you know, you're get a purple state, right? It was amazing. When I covered Obama here in 2008, yeah, you went for Obama twice.
Oh, just once.
Oh, just once. Wait, Romney?
08.
08.
Yep.
Romney, then Trump won twice.
Yes.
Right. So I don't know. You know, people are saying that where North Carolina, where Ohio and Texas go, so goes the rest of the country. You all have a really special place in this conversation. And I want to talk about what North Carolinians in this state are going to do and not what's going to happen or not happen in Congress. That, frankly, to me is not even part of my, it's not even what I spend the most time thinking about anymore.
So it sounds like both a kind of grounding of your work in the practical, but also, you know, a little cynical maybe of saying, gosh, these folks in Congress, they're not going to get it done. And you would certainly not be the only person to feel that way about the U.S.
man.
Congress.
Oh, man. Am I old enough now to be cynical? I did not. I try not to be cynical, you know? Like,
I'm younger than you, and I think cynical, so, you know.
I'm one of those people that I watch a Billy Wilder movie, and I don't think it's cynical. I just think it's realistic, you know? It's grounded. It's also, here's a point of optimism. In many ways, I'm thinking about how LGBTQ rights happen state by state. Right? Same-sex marriage didn't just happen, right? Like, that's a decades-long, state-by-state, organized, media-oriented. Talk about media-oriented, right? Like, introducing LGBTQ characters as people, as capable of love, as family members. I mean, when I immigrated here in 93, that was already kind of Will and Grace, Ellen DeGeneres move. You know, that was already part of kind of the context that we were being provided, The Birdcage. I remember watching The Birdcage when I was in middle school thinking, like, what am I watching? And I'm not even, wait, back then I wasn't even out as gay. So I think in many ways immigrant rights is going to go in the same way as LGBTQ rights going state by state. And while that's happening, as someone who's a writer and a filmmaker and a storyteller, what can I do on that front? Right, to make sure, for example, if you go to our website, which I hope you do, defineamerican.com, we actually have an immigrant representation scale. It's like a 15-minute quiz that you can take, and it's specifically for writers, television writers and film writers, playwrights who are trying to create characters, and we ask you a series of questions just to make sure you don't fall into tropes, that you don't fall into the good immigrant versus bad immigrant, that you remember that there are Black immigrants out there who are undocumented, who are, for the most part, left out of the conversation, that the fastest growing undocumented population are coming from Asia, not Latin America, right? That most people here who are Latino are U.S.-born American citizens and not undocumented people. So these are called facts, right? And the facts inform the narrative, right? So that's the work that I'm trying to get done. And thankfully, it's also a work where I don't have to, like, expose myself. I have a dear friend here, Diane, who I spent 2 years literally just talking about myself. And, you know, as a journalist, we're not supposed to do that. Don't lead the story. It was so disorienting the first 2 years of doing this work. Everybody just wanted to just tell me your story. And I'm like, can I tell you about other people's stories? So it's been, in some ways, it has been really grounding the past few years.
So you mentioned the good versus bad immigrant narrative, and I think your story and the stories that you share really challenge us to look at whether we have those beliefs, whether we see people through those lenses. Whatever our personal politics are, I think there's still a tendency to do that for a lot of people.
Yeah.
You also challenge us to see the immigrant stories, or challenged me to see the immigrant stories in myself. My grandmother came here in 1938. She was a Jewish refugee from Germany. She got out right in the nick of time because she was very fortunate to get a visa. She, you know, married a serviceman, learned English, raised a family, helped run a business, etc. So, like, perfect, good immigrant story. Mm-hmm. But if she had not gotten that visa but had still done everything else, she would be, you know, an undocumented or illegal person, to use the pejorative term that would have been used then. And, you know, it just got me thinking, like, the only difference in that would be whether my grandmother had a piece of paper or not.
Yeah.
And, yeah, reading your book really made me consider that. And how do you challenge that good versus bad immigrant narrative, those... How does your work right now engage with that theme in particular?
And I think this is... Well, I'm going to answer that question in a backwards way. This is why I think I'm so drawn to telling stories, because they don't exist in binaries. You know, we live in a world right now where everybody, I think, is so forced to paint things in these black or white, legal or illegal, these terms that leave little room for complexity and nuance. And the stories that I'm most attracted to are the ones where it's all nuance, where it's all the ones where you're like, as it turns, you're, oh, what would I have done, right? And I have to say that in talking about this journey that I'm on, that is where I find the most comfort, is when I can go, I'm telling you this so you can look at it like that. So exactly what you just said, right? Like, it's either you look at stories as mirrors where you see yourself, or you tell a story and open a window, if not a door, so somebody can go walk in and be like, wait. But to be honest, though, I'm amazed of the kind of historical amnesia that Americans have when it comes to this, right? Because unless you're an African-American, you know, who were forced to come here, kidnapped, or Native American whose land this belonged to, you came from somewhere. Why do I have to remind you this? Doesn't your own story remind you of that? And the fact that you have to listen to other people's stories to remind yourself of your own, that's wonderful. But I hope that at this time when the country is going through this self-examination, I think every family must be going through its own self-examination. And how do we do that and not fall into what you just said, which is not make it Democrat or Republican and not make it partisan at all? How do we do that? I think that is the challenge. I mean, yesterday, even at this book event that I was in, there were a few people that read Dear America who said to me that they can't talk to their neighbors because of how they think about something. And I'm like, wait, like, so if you're not going to go do that, who's going to do that for you? Tucker Carlson? how many people here are aware of PragerU? Prager. Are you Prager familiar? It's like basically a turbocharged Fox News, right? It's the kind of thing that Rush Limbaugh would have been proud of, right? And so I heard about it when I was visiting Miami University in Ohio, which I didn't know was a conservative school. And I was being debated by the college Republicans who didn't want me to be in the school talking about immigration. And so when I asked them, hey, where do you get your information? They said, PragerU. And I thought it was like a TED Talk, like PragerU is at a university. Looked it up on YouTube, and it's this, you can literally binge watch an ideology by the weekend. You can binge watch an anti-immigrant ideology by just going on PragerU. And then I was looking at it on YouTube, where I live. I spend more time on YouTube than I think any other platform. And I was amazed and stunned, really, that no one on our side, on the immigrant as human side, was going up against it. So at Define American, we actually last year published a report that maps out the Great Replacement Network. This is a free report. Go to our website. We literally scoured the digital landscape and said, what gets said on PragerU is what you read in the Washington Post, and you may hear it on NPR, and you may. It's this wide network, right? And our side, which is about what are the facts, what's the context, what's the human story, is not at all a part of, there isn't a concentrated effort in going up against it.
And why is that?
Because in many ways, and this is an overgeneralization, so anybody listening to this, I apologize in advance. Because in many ways, the anti-immigrant establishment, and it is an establishment, they actually know more about immigration as a process than the pro-immigrant people themselves. Let me repeat this. The anti-immigrant establishment, that talk radio, Fox News, you know, digital influencers live on, is a multi-billion dollar empire. And they know more about immigrants and immigration as a process than the people that we had to keep reminding them that Barack Obama deported 3 million people. Like when Trump was elected and people were like, oh my God, Trump is horrible. We're like, oh, did you know what happened during Obama? And they're like, wait, what? And then you get into these arguments because they get really upset. Because, you know, and I'm like, look, I was a political reporter covering Obama. I think it's still too soon to look at Obama's legacy. But clearly, he did a lot of good. But also, clearly, there are a lot of things that were not quite as good. And anyone in this country, we live in a country where there's 60 million Latinos. right? They are by far the largest minority group. This book that I'm finishing now, that I'm writing, I'm supposed to finish, I'm making an argument that in many ways Mexicans in this country, right? Because out of the 60 million, 40 million are Mexican, the dominant ethnic group. Mexicans in this country right now are what Germans were in the 19th century, right? They're the dominant American group. And yet, because this anti-immigrant establishment has been so successful, you have all of these Mexicans, Mexican-Americans growing up being force-fed, utter, pernicious about who they are and what their place is in this country.
And it's interesting that you mention that, part of the other half of my family is Mexican-American. Mm. And I think people often forget, when you look through a historical lens, in the 1800s, there were hundreds of German language newspapers. Germans were viewed as kind of, a lot of people thought they couldn't be assimilated.
What did Benjamin Franklin say about Germans?
Yeah.
Right. So
I don't know, but I'm guessing it wasn't great.
Not great. And also I found that, so this country right now, we consume more salsa than ketchup. There are more taquerias and there are burger joints. In this country right now, more than 50% of all public school students, K-12 in the state of Texas and California, the two largest states, are Latino, mostly Mexican. So Mexican Americans and Latinos by and large are not minority groups. They're actually in many ways the mainstream and will continue to be the mainstream. Now, the anti-immigrant establishment would like to call that the great replacement. I would like to propose that it's actually the great replenishment, because that's what the country does. That's what this country has always done, right? I mean, what are you going to do? Tell the Germans and the Greeks that, you know, they didn't replenish this country, and you know where they're going to go first? Their culture. In our country, do you know why most American cities have symphonies and orchestras? German influence. I did not know that. That's why there's a Milwaukee. I did not know. Right? And so in the same way that German culture brought all these positive things, so this Mexican culture. And guess what? Most of the country actually used to belong to Mexico. Right? It's not like Germany's next door. Right? And so, and also this idea of the Americas. Right? Like when we launched Define American, in the very beginning, people would come up and like, wait, why are you trying to America is Central America and South America. I'm like, yes. That's the whole point, right? And so this is a conversation that, in my opinion, doesn't really fit kind of the news cycle, right? This is history. And history to me is not what actually happened in the past. In this country right now, you can make an argument that history is what we are unwilling to face.
So obviously you focus a lot on facts. I didn't know that about the symphonies, which is really interesting. I'm going to look into that more.
Fascinating.
But I think most people, if you just said immigrant, they would picture probably someone Latino, mm-hmm. Mexican. And yes, that is the largest group. But here in Charlotte, Mexican Americans are our number one group. And Indian Americans are the second largest group. And
yes.
You know, if you look at North Carolina, you've also got China and Vietnam in the top seven countries where people are coming from. And I don't think most people know that or think about that. Do you find that we are moving closer to or farther from these kind of basic facts in
farther from it.
Oh, okay.
Farther from it. And also, again, I am... Journalism is like religion to me. Like reporting is probably the first thing that I learned how to really do. Like, what does it mean to report? It means your opinion actually doesn't matter as much. It means like you have to get to know things that you don't know and challenge what you assume. Like that was how I grew up, right? And so facts we're getting away from. But for me, the context, because facts without context, you know, I need to understand the bigger picture, right? So here's the bigger picture. We live in a country where there are 45 million immigrants. I don't know if you all knew that. 45 million immigrants, 800,000 or so in North Carolina, right? I think those are the numbers out of Pew.
Yep.
1 out of 10 North Carolinian is an immigrant. 1 out of 6 people in Charlotte is an immigrant.
Correct.
We're not counting their kids. We're just counting the foreign-born right? So 1 out of 6, 1 out of 10. 45 million immigrants across the country. In the next 50 years, 88% of the population growth of the country is going to come from those 45 million immigrants, who are mostly Latino, Asian, and Black. So 1 out of 10 Black people in this country is a Black immigrant. If it wasn't for Black immigrants, the Black population would have actually decreased, right? And Asian, all of the Filipinos, Indians, Chinese, Vietnamese that have changed the western part of the country are now all over the South. I was pretty stunned. So in this book that I'm trying to finish, I actually have a map of the country and I place where the 45 million immigrants are in the map. So Mississippi, the fourth largest immigrant group in Mississippi are Filipinos. I did not know. I went there. I found them. North Dakota, the number one immigrant group in North Dakota are Filipinos. What? They can't all be nurses. Like, what just happened? So teachers, a lot of teachers. I didn't know that we're importing not only nurses, but teachers, because we don't pay enough. We don't have enough teachers in this country, right? And we go to the Philippines to actually get teachers and then get them here. And there's some interesting stories actually about how unfortunate some of the processes have been. And so you can Google that away. But yeah, so those are the facts. And but the big story, though, is what the anti-immigrant establishment has called the Great Replacement. How do we counter that? So this is the first chapter in a book. This is the Great Replenishment. That's how I'm framing it. And I don't want to just make this all about food, but all you got to do is look at the food, you know, like, and know and face the fact that, you know, if it wasn't for all those immigrants, the food in all of our places, like Charlotte, or I was just in Charleston, and I'm like, which is going through a really great kind of immigrant. There's a lot of immigrant groups there, but also it's a foodie town, right? That's because there's a lot of immigrants. So I'm actually starting to think that maybe food as culture and food as a way to break bread and experience each other, that may be something that we're considering at Define America in terms of what we can do with that, right?
Yeah, and I think just right here in Charlotte, you know, there's close to where I live, there's a Korean restaurant across from a Brazilian restaurant next to this great, you know, authentic Chinese restaurant. And it's like these pockets of diversity in the South, which has traditionally been a Black-white color divide, really starting to scramble things a bit more. And not just here in Charlotte and North Carolina, but as you point out, in many places.
In many places in the South.
Yeah. And do you find that makes your work easier? Like, are people more open to seeing their immigrant neighbors and those stories around them because of this great replenishment that's happening? Or are some people more resistant?
I think for me, and again, this is the journalism me trying to understand this from a storytelling perspective, I actually think telling the stories of food, sports, the arts, I think these are the places that people don't necessarily think that politics are a part of, that we can find a way to connect people, right? I actually think they may be the only place, right? I mean, when I'm not at all a football person, but it's so interesting. One of my mentors brought me to my first ever baseball game. There's a guy, Shohei Ohtani.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Japanese player, tall guy. I guess he's a good player. I don't know how to judge that. But we were in this baseball game that lasted for hours. I was like, when is this ending? Are we just stuck here? And then I'm sitting there, I'm going, wait a second. Like, are these are a bunch of immigrant players. Like, where would baseball be without immigrant players, right? So now we're, like, thinking about what to do. So I apologize for my own, like, you know, naivete. I just did it. I'm not a baseball person. So, but sports, I think, is that main, quote-unquote, mainstream American thing in which the players themselves and the people who are watching the players are redefining who and what an American is. So I think there's a way to do that. And I think there's a way to do that – and realize that we're actually not talking about those people. We're talking about our people. Because that's the thing, right? Like, how do we get to this thing where... So when you say that one out of six people here in Charlotte are immigrants, so what does that mean in terms of institutions in Charlotte? Like, what do you all celebrate? Who's elected in public office? What's taught in schools, right? Like, do we only talk about Latinos when it's Hispanic Heritage Month, which, by the way, people don't want to be called Hispanic, right? Like, so all of these things, right? Again, what does it mean locally?
And, you know, talking about the media and how we portray people, I know Define American did an analysis of North Carolina media, yes, storytelling. Yes. And
you are our guinea pig.
Yeah.
We picked North Carolina. The report is on the website. It's free. Just download it.
It's a great report. I would endorse it. I learned a lot, actually. Yeah. And I'll let you talk about the specifics a bit, but in general, you found that immigrants are often portrayed only in political stories or in the context of criminals or victims, and that there is, overrepresentation in stereotypes and tropes.
In tropes.
Yeah.
So Liz Robbins, who was at the New York Times, was actually the person in our team that led this report, right? So she spent a lot of time in North Carolina, actually partnered with journalists who worked in North Carolina. And if you look at the report, I think what it does is paint a picture of, so you're a state where one out of 10, resident is an immigrant. And yet the way you cover that those groups of people that are your people is in such a way that needs to be better integrated in this everyday life. Right? Oh, look, they're playing sports. Oh, they're opening restaurants. Oh, there's those church functions. Or, oh, there's an opportunity to actually make sure that North Carolina, and this is the challenge that across the country, when we did our report, there's not a single reporter in North Carolina who's charged on reporting on immigration as a beat. Do you know what that means as a yes. beat?
Well, we have a Report for America reporter, Bella, who I believe is here, Kayla. There
Hi.
She is. Hello.
Amazing.
And Kayla reports on immigration as a beat for us and La Noticia, Spanish language newspaper. And I think one thing your report pointed out is that we often silo that.
Yeah.
And, it's like, okay, this is immigration news, not just this
North Carolina news. Yes, right? Mm-hmm. Thank you for reading that. That to me is one of the biggest takeaways. But also, what does it mean, though, given the state of local and state journalism, right? That's why, to me, like, the partnerships are really important, because that's what needs to happen now. And I think newsrooms need to be less territorial and more collaborative. Journalism and local journalism is under attack. And as somebody, I grew up in newsrooms. I started my first job was in 1998. So to see like the death of newspapers, to me, we were just talking about, the Charlotte Observer. I mean, that was one of the newspapers when I was a kid I wanted to work at. And now you said how many reporters are at the Observer?
I think the newsroom size is somewhere around 40, depending how you count it.
In Charlotte, so that's just bananas crazy. So more than ever, journalism needs to survive and exist. And while it's doing that, making sure that it actually reflects the community that it deserves. And guess what? That's actually good business. That's good journalism, right? And how do we bring more people together? I'm glad that you all do events, but I don't know how many events you all do, but I actually think those are the kind of things that can make people feel like there's a civic culture that they're a part of.
So what do we need to do better in the media? And I know that the media is too broad, but
yeah.
Let's talk about local media then. What do you think local news organizations need to do better?
And you already named kind of for us is really the number one thing is don't silo your immigration coverage. Look at your state as a changing state, right? And changing, by the way, for the reality of the changing. It doesn't have to be bad change. It doesn't have to be taking away of something. It's about what's being added, actually, or to use the word, what's being replenished. And how do you cover that across all of these everyday things that everyday North Carolinians go through. I think there's that. I think more collaboration. I think making sure that you all are in touch with, and your reporter, I'm sure, is already doing this, in touch with all of the local organizations that have direct service access to these immigrant groups. To me, what's really exciting, and I think what was a real opportunity, is how do you bring AAPI immigrants, Latino immigrants, and Black immigrants all together? And how do you get them in front of all white people and say, oh, before you were white, you were an immigrant too, right? What is that conversation like, right? What is that conversation like?
Yeah, and that's an interesting, just to go back to the historical fact, I sometimes think about if you were to time travel back in time, you know, to like 1850 and find a new Irish immigrant and be like, hey.
Or English, yeah, you're in North Carolina. Yeah.
Say, hey, in 150 years, like, Irish will be synonymous with white. They would laugh you out of the room because they would say, no, those
they'd
are
be
obviously.
So offended.
Yeah, they'd say no.
Offended.
Obviously, Irish people are something very different.
Very different.
But now, if you told us.
And like, so were Germans.
Yeah, and Italians and Eastern Europeans and Jewish immigrants from Europe and many groups that we now, you know, don't really think too much about as different. And I just think forward into the future and I'm like, man, in 150 years, will people read your book and say, oh, wow, like they really thought someone from the Philippines was that different? Like,
especially because, you know, the Philippines was the first exercise in empire. Actually, I was in North Carolina,
Wilmington?
Hyatt, somewhere. Not that.
We're just going to
it's
yell.
Just a lot. It was just
we're
a lot.
Just
going to
yell city names at you now.
So I was doing this event in North Carolina, and I started saying that there are 4 million immigrant Filipinos in America, right? And that was a few years ago. So now it's 4.4 million immigrants. 4.4 million Filipinos in America. So the largest immigrant group in California, Mexican, then Filipinos are the two groups. Nevada, Mexicans, Filipinos. There's a whole movement now of Mexicans and Filipinos marrying each other and calling themselves Mexipinos. This is amazing. 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 The best flans you can find are from the Mexipinos, right? So I was saying this, you know, and I was happy to say this. And this gentleman at the back said, why are there so many of you here? And he said this and not, clearly he has not had Filipino food. You know, and I was like, how do I be polite? And I said, well, you know, sir, we are here because you were there. He was like, what? You know, sir, like, you took the Philippines. You bought it from Spain for $20 million in 1898. Right? We were your first exercise in empire. We were the first Vietnam. We were the first Iraq. And he just looked at me. He was like, what are you talking about? Sir, like, open a history book. Mark Twain, actually, I just visited this museum, was one of the most ardent anti-imperialists. He was the one saying, America, don't do this. We can't do this. This is not who we are. Right? And so when the immigrants come here, there's a reason why we come here. Right? Why are Mexico? What happened with NAFTA? Right? What's happened to El Salvador? Like, why do we need to grant people TPS? Like, all of these things are actually interconnected. And for me, though, as a journalist, if we in the news media are not connecting these dots and telling these stories, who else is going to do it? And what's the role of television and movies and play? Like, what is the role of the stories we tell to be responsible to the future that we all have together? Because to me, it's actually a responsibility. You know, I don't believe in art for art's sake. The world is, you know, is on fire. I don't believe in entertainment just for entertainment. And we live at a time in which entertainment can be fascism for some people, right? Where everything can be propaganda. And so these things actually matter. And I think the role of the media in being accountable to the people and to this moment in history is, you know, I don't want to get all Marshall McLuhan, but like, you know, Marshall McLuhan, are you familiar with this guy, Marshall McLuhan? The medium is the message. This man came up with one of the most really discerning statements of the 20th century. And he said it and like he disappeared. I don't know what happened after. The medium is the message. He was right then and he's right now. Yeah.
His point was that the way in which information is presented, television at the time mm-hmm. he was working, shaped people's thoughts and minds and as much as the content of that message.
As much as the content of it. It's and this is where I think being a television culture doesn't necessarily mean we become a literate culture. Right? And that's why when people are fighting against history, like what's happening in Florida right now, and all of these conversations around critical race theory, all of these, you know, I was one of those people when I was growing up that when I went to Borders, you know, the bookstore, and I'm like, wait, why did they put the black authors in a corner? Like, why isn't Toni Morrison next to Ernest Hemingway? Like, why, you know, like, so this idea that we have sequestered all of these people, and this gets me, you're bringing up the idea of like the Italians and the Germans. I'm researching kind of the genesis of the melting pot, of the term melting pot, and finding out that it actually has nothing to do with the people in this room. The melting pot was about how the European immigrants got to melt onto one thing because they can, you know. And in many ways, this country that invented black and white also invented Hispanic and Asian. AAPI doesn't exist outside of America, right? 63% of the world's people are from Asia. Asian people are the world's majority. At least Latinos, for the most part, have Spanish in common. And you have Telemundo and you have, you know, Univision, right? What do Koreans, Chinese, Filipinos, and Vietnamese have in common outside of noodles and rice? Nothing. Not even the same language. Maybe the same curry. But, right? And in this country, they're one thing. And we have this thing called BIPOC. I'm still trying to understand. In the book, I kind of unpack that, like BIPOC and what it means. And I understand the sentiment, right? Which is the black and indigenous experience are totally unique in this country. But then people of color are Latinos and Asians. So wait, where do they, are we making assumptions that all of these groups are the same? And I'm all, the Washington Post right now is the only newsroom in the country that is capitalizing white. Have you noticed this?
I actually haven't, no.
So, because after George Floyd, thankfully this has become a norm where black is capitalized. But the Washington Post said, if you're going to capitalize black, you have to capitalize white. No one has followed. I think it's actually a very interesting proposition that's worth consideration, because it actually represents, when we say white, we're talking about something very specific, right? And I think we have to get specific before we jump into the whole people of color are all the same, because they're not. And all you have to do is look at the two Indian Americans running for president in the Republican side to know that the BIPOC, the construction of BIPOC, needs interrogation.
And do you find...
This book is going to get me in way more trouble than coming out as undocumented. Well, I'm going to say that right now.
We'll talk about that
but
in a minute.
Yes.
And, you know, you mentioned politics a few times. I feel like we've been kind of dancing around politics. It's going to be 2024 before we know it.
I know.
And how do you want to engage people around politics? Because I know you don't see yourself as a left-right, this party, that party guy, but how are you going to engage people around the elections that are coming up?
Well, by the way, don't get me wrong. As an undocumented gay Filipino, I'm forced to be in the progressive side, but I think that says more about the conservative side than the progressive side, right? Like it says a lot more about the Republican Party that as an undocumented gay Filipino, I can't find myself in there than about like what being progressive means. In my opinion, we should all be for progress. That's how history moves, right? So let me just say that first. The second thing is let me really personalize this. I have to be honest, like not being able to vote has been psychologically weighing on me as I get older and older. I've been in this country 30 years. I pay lots in taxes and I cannot vote. And so to think of elections that are won by like 50,000 50,000 vote margins, 500 vote margins, in many ways, immigrants in this country, particularly undocumented immigrants and undocumented North Carolinians, you can make an argument that they can't check out. There's no opting out. You kind of have to be in. But to think of all of the people, even maybe particularly in the state, that don't vote, that don't take that privilege seriously or think that it doesn't matter, that to me is, I really struggle wrapping my head around that. So I hope that, my hope is we all realize, and I think we all, people who are certainly in this room, know what's on the line and that opting out is not an option. But then what do we do with the rest of the people that don't participate, right? And also, now this is controversial, but hey. So these undocumented immigrants, workers, neighbors that are part of your communities, should they be allowed to vote in like local elections or school boards? If they're sending their kids to your school districts, shouldn't they have a voice in that school district? How about that as a series of conversations for WFA, mm-hmm. right? Like, great question. I don't know, mm-hmm. right? And in a country where taxation without representation, I think that's a really important conversation to have. And what does having a vote mean, you know? And I remember when I was at the Post, when I was a political reporter, the executive editor, Leonard Downey, gave a speech in the basement of the Washington Post newsroom and said that he didn't think political reporters should vote.
I remember that was a big thing when I started my newspaper career in 2004 with my first paid internship, and it was probably around that time because I remember that was a big topic of conversation.
So you know, I'm listening to this. I'm like, wait, what? What is he saying? And then the Post, even then and now, has a lot of black reporters and editors, right? And it just so happens that most of my mentors growing up in the Washington Post newsroom were black women and men, you know, were my editors and my mentors. And my editor at the time, Marcia Davis, I can see her sitting down, as Len Downey was saying this, I can see her like shaking. And she's not one of those people that like speaks up in like large groups. She finally gets up. And I hope Marcia doesn't hate me for saying this in this conversation, but here it is. She gets up and she goes, my ancestors died for this vote, Len. And it is my responsibility to them that I have to vote. She was shaking. And that right there, I think, really underscored also the racial dynamics of the vote, right? And I remembered when I was covering Obama, you know, there was a time when Obama wasn't winning South Carolina, right? Where Clinton was ahead of Obama. It was Clinton, Edwards, and Obama in South Carolina. And I went down there. Where was I? Columbia? I was in Columbia, South Carolina. And I was talking to a bunch of voters. And one of them said to me, African-American voter said to me, Mr. Vargas, we don't throw away our vote. Because I was asking, you know, hey, are any here Ralph Nader voters? No offense to Ralph Nader, right? And they were like, oh, no. We're not Ralph Nader voters here. We don't throw away our vote. And I'm like, oh, that's very interesting. And it was interesting, too, because when I was in college, I majored in political science and African American studies. And so because of that, I had to understand what who Ella Baker was, who Fannie Lou Hamer was. I had to understand really the history of the franchise, right? And then I was working with these white journalists who had no idea who Ella Baker was or Fannie Lou Hamer or just the history of like what black people had to fight through to get the right to vote while we were covering the first African American running for president. So this is where you can't really remove these contexts from the conversation, right? Thankfully, I think when it comes to race, in many ways, I think, you know, with Nicole Hannah-Jones, the 1619 Project, I think there are now an understanding that you can't talk about race in America without making sure that black people are driving and are a part of that conversation. I wish I could say the same about the immigrant conversation, but it's not. That's not where we are when it comes to talking about immigration. And that's why I think black immigrants, right, and the role of black immigrants in the country and how we talk about what it means to be a black immigrant in a country that is changing, I think that's such fertile ground and so important. At Define American, we work with many black organizations just to make sure that when we talk about immigration, we don't isolate it as this Latino thing or Asian thing, that we see immigration as something that you can't divorce from race because you can't.
And so you have obviously, I think, your own perspective on this. Tell me about what you're doing to bring other people's narratives and stories into the conversation. How are you working to make sure or try to make sure that these conversations about immigrants aren't happening without immigrants involved, as
you're
saying?
So I think when you see the programming that we have, that's pretty evident, right, in terms of, like, you know, again, the immigrant representation scale. I'm really proud of this. We work with Define American, work with Andaki Poets and other organizations. So the Pulitzer Committee changed its requirements. They have now opened it so that you don't have to be a quote-unquote U.S. citizen to apply or to be considered for the Pulitzer Prize. That was the case before. And for us, that was really important because if the Pulitzer Committee and the board can change its requirements, what stop? I don't know if you all have looked at your own requirements and like honors and fellowships and scholarships. Too many of them have like a boilerplate language that says U.S. citizens only, U.S. residency required, or you have to be a U.S. citizen. And these are mostly coming from well-meaning people, right? But they haven't examined, wait a second, like, who are you leaving out? So I would really implore, if you work at an arts organization, right, because so many artists depend on scholarships, fellowships, and honors to, like, get their work supported, I would hope that you can look into that. So that's a big part, too. We just had that win a couple of weeks ago.
Right. And this probably just shows, you know, the depths of, you know, what you don't understand, or as, you know, as someone who was born here, what I don't have to understand.
Yeah.
Until I read about that, I never realized that had been a requirement for the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah. And you know, and now, thankfully, this is amazing. This, to me, is one of the most optimistic part, is there's now a canon of undocumented, formerly undocumented writers. Javier Zamora Solito is an amazing book. Carla Cornejo Villasencio, The Undocumented Americans, is an amazing book. Grace Dalusan, The Body Paper. So like, there's now like a growing canon of work. When Dear America came out in 2018, I remember my publisher saying, immigration books don't sell, Jose. So we can't really market your book as an immigration book because it's not going to sell. So that was, I thought, interesting. And now it's like, oh, they're selling. But they're selling because there's stories that people should know about, right?
So before we turn it over and ask for audience questions, which we'll do in a minute.
Ask me whatever you want. Ask me. No off limits.
Your book, Dear America, it's, I think, really, obviously personal as a memoir, but really, really raw. And you're very open in that book about kind of the, moving from the closet of being undocumented and not having people know to then the difficulty of coming out, telling your story, and then kind of being a symbol or, you know, a figure in some ways. And
which I was not prepared for.
And you write about, you know, how it is difficult. You keep people at a remove sometimes because of, I think the way you put it is, you know, you don't want to draw them into your mess. It's been 5 years since that book was published.
Yeah.
How are you personally? Has that changed? Have you found a more comfortable way to exist in your narrative?
Okay.
well, you said ask anything.
That's
so.
True. Okay. great question. So I actually wrote the book planning to leave, right? The first line of the book is, I don't know where I'll be when you read it. And the last line is my mother telling me it's time to come home. And, you know, when you write a book, at least in my contract, I was obligated to promote it for 6 months. And then I was like, okay, I'll promote it for 6 months. It came out in September 2018. I figured I have until February of 2019, and then I can take the money, the book advance, and I can leave. Because to be honest, I don't want to be like a walking problem. This being undocumented for me is a condition that I did not, you know, it's a legal condition, certainly, right? But I didn't want to be this walking thing, as if everything I do is seen in that prism. You know, I have plays to write. I have movies I want to direct. There's things I want to do. And I don't want to be just this person that my life is already physically limited because of where I can't go. I don't want my work to be limited either. So I thought I was going to leave. And then I got a call from the superintendent of the school district that I attended as a kid in Mountain View, and who said that they were considering renaming a public elementary school after me, which I thought was a joke. So I was like, wait, can they even legally do that? Can you legally name a school after someone who's here illegally? And they had two other candidates, Steve Jobs, who went to the same school district as I did not know that, and Barack and Michelle Obama elementary school. So I figured they would win. I figured, you know, oh, this is so sweet, cool. Somebody wrote me in as like a, you know, candidates. And then to my surprise, I think a few months later, we voted and you have the school. It's named after you. And I was like, whoa, what if I screw up? Like, what are you doing? I'm not dead yet, you know? And then I remember thinking to myself, wait a second. So 400 kids, K to fifth grade. So if I leave, when they're asked, who's this guy? What are they going to say? It got too hard, he left. So, but I'm also not a martyr. I'm way too, my eyebrows are way too pronounced for martyrdom. You know, for martyrdom. So then I had to really figure out, wait a second. So I don't want to be your undocumented. I am not a spokesperson for anybody but myself. I am trying to do the best that I can with the resources that I have and with the skills that I know. I'm not a politician. I'm not an advocate. People call me an advocate. I'm like, okay, I guess I'm advocating for more stories. I don't know. Whatever. So I had to really make sure that I create my own boundaries and be like, okay, who am I and what do I do? So part of the boundary for me was I am creatively borderless. Right? I'm finishing this book. I'm helping produce David Byrne's Broadway musical. If you're in New York, check it out. It's called Here Lies Love. Fatboy Slim and David Byrne wrote it. It's about Imelda Marcos and the People Power Revolution. It's amazing. I have Define American. So my work is existing in all these ways. And personally, I gave myself this amazing gift of a therapist. I highly recommend it. I resisted it for a while. But after the book, you know, because I think growing up, I just was like, you know, if my grandmother, who's 86-year-old, didn't need a therapist, you know, suck it up, Jose. But the therapy has been actually, that's probably been the best gift for myself, to allow myself that.
Well, great. Thank you for sharing all that. And I know we have a few minutes here for questions. So if you want to ask a question, raise your hand and someone will bring you a mic.
Hello.
And please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Chris Villapando. I immigrated to this country 50 years ago.
From?
Fleeing martial law from the Philippines. Okay. first of all, I want to thank you for all of your insights.
Oh.
And I think the circumstances right now is conferring on you a role that you may or may not want, but it is there because of who you are, your experience, and your insights. There are two things that come to my mind right now. You paint these two major gigantic narratives, the replacement theory group narrative, and then this other group here.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, what would be the necessary ingredients in this other narrative that could trump this narrative here, which is so powerful because it resonates deeply in the inside of a lot of people who have these grievances, and it panders to their lower basic self. So, and this narrative is so easily consumable, like fast food, whereas this other narrative, which need about 3, 4, 5, 6 different ingredients, how do you make this narrative sustain that kind of jolting empathy, which is drying up because of this other narrative?
Yeah. Maraming salamat po for the question, huh? Maraming salamat means thank you very much in Tagalog. What a great question. You know, even coming up with replenishment, like that word, I was like, what positive word can I come up with? What concept can I come up with that is expansive enough that could contain all of this? Because no one wants to be replaced. Let me just say that out loud. No one wants to be replaced. And I have to tell you, traveling around the country, I made a documentary for MTV called White People a few years ago. And I was so that documentary aired on MTV July 2015, a month after Trump announced he was running for president. And I remember meeting with a bunch of my political reporter friends a few months later. And I said to all of them, I think Trump may actually win this election. And they all looked at me like I was crazy. And then I said, well, you know, I've been traveling around the country filming, making a documentary called White People. Like, I think I have some insights here. And what was interesting was I would meet all these young white people. And I don't know what their political orientation is. I can make assumptions, but I don't want to assume. Who would come up to me and say, I don't want to be that. I'm like, what's that? I don't want to be that straight white guy that everybody's up against. How do I not be that? And I'm looking at them, I'm like, I'm not a straight white guy, so I don't know. Like, I don't know. But I could hear this kind of like, oh, you know, I'm not the enemy here. I'm not the enemy here. And, you know, I didn't really know how to hold it. And I just remembered telling a few of them, the fact that you're asking me this question tells me that you're not that person. And then that's when I think started thinking about white supremacy as an ideology, right? That's so mainstream now, white supremacy, as an ideological thing, as a system, as institutions. And how do we separate that? What is the separation of that from the individuals? Where do they intersect and where do they actually are not? And your question to me is about how do we make sure that in this replenishment that white people and black people, I would make an argument that in the immigrant rights, in the work that I've gotten to know in the past 12 years, I don't think we've done a good job in the immigrant community, the non-black immigrant community, talking to black Americans, right? So when I go to like Mississippi or I go to Wisconsin and I meet African Americans who are like, wait, like they're taking our jobs. Wait a second. I don't, who do I drag? Who do I go with me here to talk to them about? No. We're not taking away, we don't want to take away a slice of the pie. We want to make the pie bigger, right? So The very long answer to your question, sir, is I think figuring out a way where we acknowledge that something is changing, because we can't lie to people. Something is changing. By the way, it's been changing for a while. And you know who knows that? Businesses. That's why you have press number two if you want to hear in Spanish, right? That's why, you know, most of your call-in centers are now in the Philippines. I did not know this until a few months ago. My sister, who I sent to nursing school in the Philippines, now wants to work at a call center because it pays more than being a nurse in the Philippines, which I think is fascinating. We need to come up with a proposition that it really includes everyone. And in a way that tells people that they're a part of that replenishment. And we need to do that. Because if the anti-immigrant, the multi-million dollar organized and disciplined are not two words that come up when you talk about progressives, right? Because it's a big umbrella of people. And to me, we have to make that work for us, which means it exists in all these different things. That to be American, to define American, can exist in all of these different things. That it's not one thing. And if you think about it, in many ways, that harkens back to the idea of America as an idea, as more than just a place. But I think there are people who come up to me who say, I don't want to be American, Jose. I said, I hear that, you know, but we're here. This is the place. That's the city hall. Those are the taxes. So what are we a part of? And maybe the long way of quoting Baldwin, right? You know, our history, you know, is each other. That's the only guide.
Thanks. Another question. See you in the back. I saw your hand first, so you win.
Thank you. You hold it. Okay.
Yeah, we insist on holding the mics.
Okay.
It's a legal requirement or something.
Yeah. Hi, Jose. I'm Priya. Hey, Federico.
Hi.
Hi. I'm an immigrant as well. Thank you for this conversation. I am curious about what you think about generational dynamics in this whole conversation, and I'll just share briefly that, something that I've experienced. I'm actually from Texas, and I've only been here for a couple years.
Where in Texas?
I grew up in Dallas-Fort Worth. I call Austin home. But I spent a lot of time working in various cities, and I've lived in other places too. And something that had struck me in my work over the years is, and I lived in New York for almost a decade before, a few years before coming here, and then Miami. So some different immigrant places,
yeah.
Right? And I have been struck in the last few years where I've done a lot of work in Houston, and have a lot of friends in Houston, at how it seems to me, as an immigrant and child of immigrants, as to be a very integrated community. Like, there's still separations,
yeah.
But I have noticed a lot of what I see as integration among many different, you know, people of many different racial and ethnic backgrounds and different nationalities who have then come here. And I noticed it even as someone who was living in New York and going to Houston. I felt like I was seeing, for example, more like interracial and multiracial families in Houston than in New York City, you know?
Yeah.
And more interaction than I was seeing in New York, which is supposed to be such a, you know, like, integrated place. You know, to me, hearing you speak, I think of Houston as a place where, like, even looking at racially or, you know, you probably know even more about this because of your research, but, you know, there's the third most spoken language is Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. There's huge parts of the city where all the street signs are in Vietnamese, which is really, really cool. And I could just think about, like, proximate nature and how I feel like it's just very accepted, especially in folks maybe my age and younger, that people will interact, mingle, and maybe even make families together.
Mm.
So I'm just curious, like, to me, hearing you talk about replacement, or excuse me, replenishment. I feel like Houston's an example of that.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, you may or may not agree, but I'm curious about, to me, I see a generational thing happening in Houston, and I'm wondering if that's something that you have seen or what your thoughts are.
To me, what's interesting about, thank you for bringing that up, because I'll never forget when we did, when George Floyd happened, when that murder happened, right? And it was interesting because at the time I was living in the Bay Area where you can't swing a purse without hitting someone Filipino, right? There's just a lot of Filipinos. And so my relatives, my aunties, my cousins, my nieces, everybody was there. So I remembered I went home to my Lola's house, my grandma's house, where my uncle and my aunt and my cousins lived. And we watched Selma, Ava DuVernay's masterful film on what happened in Selma, Martin Luther King. Because I realized that my immigrant relatives who are working, who got here, 84 to like 91, they passed the naturalization citizenship test. Have you all looked at a citizenship test? There's nothing on the citizenship tests about like the civil rights movement. Or how, for example, there are 45 million immigrants in this country. How did that happen? Because of the civil rights movement, right? So people coming from Asia in particular could not have come here if black people did not fight for their human rights that then allowed us to be able to come. So people don't know that, right? So I'm talking to I'm basically trying to like do a history lesson with my family to understand why George Floyd and why that was awful and why all of that. And then they got it. And then before we went to bed, my aunt was applying this cream in my niece's neck before bed. And I was asking her, Auntie Alma, what are you doing? What is that? It was a whitening cream that she got at the Korean store. So while I was explaining to my family, right, what black people in this country have gone through, and I thought, we understood it. We were getting it. We were, at some point, one of my uncle actually started crying when he was talking about, he was owning up to the fact that when he came here, he was so racist towards black people because he didn't understand, why do they live in projects? We got here, 10 years ago, and now we have a house, and how come? And I'm like, there's a reason for that there, right? He didn't know. And so he started crying, apologizing that he didn't know. And then 2 hours later, my aunt is applying a whitening cream in my niece's neck. And then my aunt goes, yeah, because the neck is the darkest part of her, and we don't want her dark. We don't? Why not? This is deep, right? And this is where I think America's racial conversation, which is in many ways black versus south, white versus black, north versus south, white versus black, now the whole world is in America. You can make an argument that the caste system in India, you're seeing some really interesting conversations happening in America right now around Indian Americans and the ceiling that they hit at work, right? Colonialism and imperialism are now living here. So to me, the intergenerational conversation that has to happen, what I wonder about is what resources can we be providing? Like where can we have these conversations, right? One other thing I'll say, I was pretty stunned to find out, I'm probably not going to put this in my book because there's no space in it anymore. I'm supposed to finish.
You mentioned that a few times. I really hope you finish your book.
You know why? Because I can see my editor going like, I need the book, Jose. It's not like I'm, I have so much going on. But I didn't know that there are millions, numbering 10 million, green card holders who have opted not to become U.S. citizens. Let me repeat. In a country where we lose elections by hundreds, if not thousands of votes, there are 10 million people who are here legally with green cards who have decided for all kinds of reasons why not to be U.S. citizens and why not to vote. Some of it is economic. It costs money to go through the citizenship process. And some people are like, I already spent money getting there and $1,000 is maybe a lot. And then my own family, I was pretty stunned to find out that some of my aunties who got here in like late 70s are like, Don, you know, like my aunt who sent kids, my cousins to college, bought two houses, drive cars, works here. She thinks of America as the place that she works. Not a place that she's a part of. Now, hold on a second. Let me repeat this. She thinks of America, and I don't know, because all the narrative around labor, labor, labor. This is where we work. And I'm like, no, auntie, like this is where you pay taxes. This is where you participate. You're a part of this. So I'm like, auntie, do you have a library card? You know, is there a center? Do you volunteer somewhere? Do you? These to me are the questions. And these to me are community questions. So practicing your citizenship has to start at the community level. And I've said this a few times now. I think local media has an opportunity to be that connector, to be actually a place where that can happen and can facilitate the happening of that.
Well, I feel like we could talk for hours.
Oh, yeah, hold on. I have to catch a flight, but yes.
Yes, he has to catch a flight, and he has to finish a book. So we promised we would get him out of here very promptly. So I'm going to have to say thank you all for joining. Let's give it up for Jose.